some ambiguity there as to what it means that the prosecution has the burden of proving the guilt of the defendant to your satisfaction beyond a reasonable doubt as to the affirmative defense. So what that really means is the prosecution has to disprove the affirmative defense beyond a reasonable doubt, and that was never made clear.
So well, how about the non-existence of an affirmative defense? That was the prior the instruction 12 said. There were two instructions, right?
Right.
12 said that the prosecution has to prove the non-existence of an affirmative defense
right.
by a reasonable doubt. Then it said the affirmative defense is self-defense. Then it said it again, the prosecution has to burden of proving it beyond a reasonable doubt, and then it explained what self-defense was. So taking all those instructions together, would the jury have gotten the understanding that they had to prove the non-existence of an affirmative defense beyond a reasonable doubt?
They still were never instructed that the prosecution has the burden of proving the non-existence of every element of self-defense beyond a reasonable doubt. That was never instructed to the jury. And that's particularly important here because, as the prosecutor said in rebuttal closing, that he said, frankly, ladies and gentlemen, this case boils down to which version we believe. So the credibility of everybody, including the defendant, is critically important here. That's why the issue of the evidence regarding the defendant's homosexuality is so important in this case, and that there was a due process violation by the government being allowed to introduce this otherwise irrelevant testimony that the defendant was a homosexual, that he met Mr. Fisher on a homosexual dating site for young gay men, and that everybody started off at a gay nightclub.
Counsel, I want to stop you there real quick. Why is this issue an issue of due process? If this is merely an issue of the admission of irrelevant evidence, that's typically not a due process issue. So why is this a constitutional issue?
Well, as my predecessor argued in the opening brief, because this type of evidence is normally so inflammatory, and it raises such strong prejudice, and I cited some cases in the reply brief as well, that it can rise to a due process violation. And both of us, I think, have to concede that normally this is an abuse of discretion. But even on an abuse of discretion standard, the trial court abuses discretion by letting in this incredibly highly inflammatory, really negative information regarding the defendant that some people, not everybody now, that some people tend to equate with homosexuals or pedophiles. Homosexuals have uncontrollable sexual urges. Homosexuals are immoral. Homosexuals are unchristian.
Pardon me for interrupting, Ms. Ruttenberg. I concede that there are people who have anti-gay bias, and I understand that. And thus, if this were simply admitted to smear the defendant, you would have, in my view, I would suggest to have a better argument. But there were hearings on this evidence, and the prosecution's position from the beginning was that this evidence was introduced to show the relationship between Mr. Moore and the driver of the car in order to establish that there was not self-defense here. Because as you recall, there was some evidence, and if the jury chose to believe it, there was some evidence that just before the violence began, just before Mr. Moore v. Moore punched the woman in the back seat, that he embraced the driver and he propositioned him by whispering in his ear. So why isn't that just simply a garden variety relevancy question followed by a garden variety 403 analysis?
Well, for the following reasons. There was no homosexual relationship between Mr. Fisher and Mr. Moore, and even Mr. Fisher denied that. He very emphatically denied that, number one. Number two, the judge ruled that the homosexual component of how they met is relevant to judge their credibility and interrelationship between all his victims. If all was introduced into evidence was these two young men had recently met on an internet chat room, that would be different. But the fact that they met in an internet chat room for young African-American homosexuals in the metro area is what goes too far.
But
that's
but
completely
again,
irrelevant.
But again, What about the evidence that defendant's defense was, I'm afraid they're taking me somewhere to harm me? And doesn't the evidence of the hug and the proposition make it less likely that he felt that he was afraid?
No, because as I said in my reply brief, first of all, two young men embracing is not a homosexual act, not in this day and age. Young men do that as a way of greeting all the time. That is not a homosexual act. Number two.
Is it relevant? If the driver just testified that Mr. Moore embraced me and said, instead of saying, let's go to a hotel, let's go bowling or something like that, it would be relevant, wouldn't it?
Well, what's relevant is when you put the driver's comment into context. What the driver said was all in one breath that the defendant first whispered in his ear about going to a motel room, and there was no proposition. I mean, that's left to an assumption that what was going to happen in the motel room. But remember, just a minute before, the defendant asked, let's go drive to my brother's house to pick up some weed. So another reasonable inference is that they were just going to use drugs in a motel room and do something else, like watch a movie.
Well, counsel, wait a minute. It seems like you're trying to have it both ways here. You're saying that comment was a comment on the defendant's homosexuality. And then you turn around and say, but the comment did indicate his homosexuality. So which is it?
Well, that comment alone wouldn't be a comment on his homosexuality, but you know, the defendant now was stuck with the judge's rulings that all this other evidence regarding the homosexuality of the two young men comes into evidence. I'm trying to respond to Judge Bernard's question that just the whispering in the ear about the motel room isn't necessarily, you don't need to show that they're both homosexuals as to why that's relevant. But remember earlier, Mr. Fisher was allowed to testify that he was a homosexual, Mr. Moore was a homosexual, they met in this homosexual chat room, and that was what was irrelevant and highly prejudicial. So then the defendant was stuck with this. So then when you get to the one remark that was made later on in Mr. Fisher's testimony attributable to the defendant, that first he said, let's go to this motel room, and then in the same breath, Mr. Fisher said the defendant thought he was being set up and even said so. He said that all in the same sentence. At first the defendant said, let's go to the motel room, and then he realized, at least from the defense perspective, that he was being set up and he thought he was going to be jumped. And Mr. Fisher testified to that all in the same sentence. Let's go to the motel room. Oh no, these bitches are trying to set me up. They're going to jump me. So that in and of itself is evidence of anybody's homosexual conduct, nor does it tend to make the prosecution's theory of the case any more probable that the defendant didn't think he was being set up. If anything, it helped the defendant at that point. But the whole point is this smearing evidence of homosexuality so that the jury would think this is an immoral person, immoral people don't tell the truth, immoral people are not Christian, immoral people have uncontrollable sexual urges. All of those things would prejudice the defendant and make the jury less likely to believe him. If there's no further questions right now, I'd like to reserve my final 3 minutes.
Certainly.
I have one question. You haven't addressed the jury challenge issue. Are you conceding that?
I'm not conceding it, Your Honor. If I don't have time to address right. that later, I will stand on my briefing on that issue.
Okay.
Good morning. I'm Y. E. Scott, and my registration number is 20342. I'd like to address one of the statements that Ms. Rosenberg made is that Mr. Fisher testified that he's a homosexual and that the defendant is homosexual. That is not in the record, and there was no such testimony from Mr. Fisher. What Mr. Fisher testified to is that he met the defendant on a gay networking dating website. That does not mean that he's a homosexual. Anybody can surf the net, land on a networking website and not even know it's a gay website at first.
What's the relevance of that evidence anyway, though? They met in a gay chat room.
A gay chat room.
And I guess he also testified that the nightclub they went to was a gay nightclub.
That's correct.
What's the relevance of that as compared to the statement about he hugged me in the car before the violence broke out?
I think the whole idea was to establish that Mr. Fisher and Mr. Moore knew each other and how they knew each other. But the ladies did not know Mr. Fisher until then. I mean, Mr. Moore until that night when they all went to the club together. I think it was more to establish what the relationship was before the parties. And that's exactly why the court said he was going to allow this testimony to come in, is because it wasn't sexual conduct or talking about their sexual orientation, but what their relationship was between the parties. I'd also like to address the Judge Bernard's question about it. Jury instruction number 14, that is the standard self-defense instruction. Do not believe that it is ambiguous in any way. But even if it were, like you said, there was another jury instruction number 12, said that they had to prove there was no existence of self-defense. And all the other, the elemental jury instructions that said what elements had to be proved, all said they had to be proved beyond a reasonable doubt without the affirmative defense. We believe that the jury was properly instructed as to the self-defense and the prosecution's burden regarding that self-defense. To answer your question, Judge Jones, about the constitutional due process, I do not believe that this is a constitutional issue for the very reason that you stated. And Ms. Lopez said this is highly inflammatory information. This is not highly inflammatory. Anybody can go to a gay bar and have a good night. We don't know whether the ladies were gay or not, and they were at a gay bar. That does not make them homosexual. Same thing with the networking website. Embracing, as Ms. Rutman said, that's not a sign that they're homosexual. And inviting someone to a hotel room doesn't mean they're homosexual. Like I said, they may have been going to do drugs. They may have been going to shoot pool. They may have been going to watch the movie. None of this information is highly inflammatory at all. But all you have to think of the jury pool that they had. They had a jury questionnaire that was specifically asked whether and what their relationship was or what their attitudes were for homosexuality. So a lot of those people that have these misconceptions about homosexual were weeded out during the voir dire.
Well, indeed, wasn't one woman, pardon me for interrupting, but wasn't one woman specifically excused for that reason?
Yes, she was. And on top of that, the judge did give the attorneys an extra 15 minutes in voir dire in order to ask all the questions they wanted. So we do not believe that this was highly inflammatory information.
Did the prosecution argue anything about the sexual preference of the defendant in the closing or the rebuttal arguments?
Not at all. We believe that the other thing about the instructions is the totality of the instructions were more than adequate for this particular case. The prosecution did mention that they were even lucky that they even got a self-defense argument at all, because in this case, the defendant was never even threatened by any of the victims. I mean, they said that when they came out of the parking lot, the argument between he and Ms. Fee was already over by the time they left the parking lot at the club, and they drove all the way from downtown Denver to Aurora, texting, listening to music, having fun, talking on the phone, and that there was no threat at all. He just thought they were going to have him set up. So we believe that the prosecution did prove that part of the case beyond a reasonable doubt. As far as the preemptory challenges, there was no argument on that here today, but I'd like to address the one that the juror H, who said she didn't trust the evidence. that that was, she was uncomfortable because of the seriousness of the case. She didn't want to, she was nodding her head when the judge said she didn't want to take, be responsible for taking someone's life away. But she also said that she had a moral conflict with doing that, and that was why she became a corporate attorney instead of a defense attorney or a prosecutor, because she was aware from all of her friends that were DAs and how they twist the evidence. We believe she was properly dismissed for cause.
If the prosecution was left with two peremptory challenges after all the challenges were over, do we even need to reach the substance of the basis for the challenge?
I would agree with you there that I don't think you do, especially since the automatic reversal, which is what Ms. Fatima asked for, applies for when the defendant is denied a peremptory challenge. In this case, he wasn't denied a peremptory challenge at all. And yes, the prosecution could have very easily removed both of these jurors.
I mean, this is the flip side of McCrander, which is what you're talking about.
Correct.
Where the prosecution is left with peremptories. But it seems from the Lefevre case, if the prosecution isn't given additional peremptories, there isn't a problem in the case. And although the opening brief says they were not, the reply brief seems to concede that the opening brief was mistaken.
That's correct.
All right.
Are there any other questions? If there are no other questions, thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Ruttenberg, you have about 3 minutes on the nose.
Thank you.
Yes, ma'am.
Regarding the challenges for cause for the jurors, first of all, I think it's clear from the record that the district court erred. I agree, though, that my predecessor appellate counsel miscounted when he was going through trying to figure out what happened. And I think it's pretty clear from the record. I went back, it's a little confusing at one point, but I went back and counted that they had two peremptories left.
So and Ms. Ruttenberg, we very much appreciate your candor in that regard.
Thank you, Your Honor. I don't believe, though, that that automatically means that this is just harmless error, that the court need not reach the merits, because now we're speculating as to what could have happened had those two challenges for cause not been erroneously issued. Would the prosecution have gone ahead and issued peremptories? And then if they had issued peremptories, would there have been another challenge regarding an improper peremptory, such as a Batson challenge?
But our Supreme Court in Lefevre didn't discuss any of those things. In Lefevre, it emphasized that prejudice occurs only if the effect here is to give the prosecution an extra challenge. And we know from counting that they did not get an extra challenge as a result of these decisions.
Correct. And the problem is we have no idea of what could have happened next, because then no record was ever made, such as regarding the racial makeup of the two excused jurors and whether there could have been then a valid challenge to the prosecution's exercise of perjury. So you can't just say, well...
But we're guessing at that, aren't we?
Of course, that's the whole problem.
But Lefevre doesn't tell us that that's a problem. Lefevre says, you know, Lefevre sets out the rules for what prejudice, for when prejudice happens. And under Lefevre, we don't have that sort of prejudice. It doesn't say that we go into all this other speculative stuff about whether there were other problems.
Your Honor, and maybe this is going to have to be a 35C issue, because again, no record was made as to whether there could have been another basis to challenge these jurors that was valid if the district court had ruled correctly that the challenges for cause were denied, and then the prosecution had tried to exercise peremptory strikes against these two jurors. So since I have just a couple of seconds left, I'd like to go back to the homosexual argument. Absolutely correct that you did not argue sexual preference in closing arguments, because it's irrelevant. And the prosecutor was allowed to put in this highly inflammatory, irrelevant evidence in there to prejudice the juror, appeal to their prejudice. Only one juror spoke up during voir dire. If the trial court had ruled correctly to begin with, then this whole inflammatory box of worms would have been opened in the first place. We would have had to have voir dire on it. We would have had the evidence on it. I think that it's disingenuous to argue that two young men in a gay chat room that go to a gay nightclub might not even be gay. Thank you, Your Honor. I'm out of time.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. We appreciate your arguments very much. The case will stand submitted and an opinion will issue in due course. Please drive safely home.